Members, the Committee on Public Integrity and Elections will come to order. Will the Administrative Assistant please call the roll?
Representative Graul?
Here.
Representative Roach?
Present.
Representative Davis?
Here.
Representative Brannon?
Here.
Representative Byrd?
Here.
Representative Costello?
Here.
Representative Clemmons?
Here.
Representative Duggan? Representative Ingolia?
Here.
Representative Killebrew?
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Coster?
Here.
Representative Perez?
Here.
Representative Silvers?
Here.
Representative Smith?
Here.
Representative Stevenson?
Here.
Representative Tant?
Present.
Representative Thompson?
Here.
Representative Valdez?
Present.
A quorum is present, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, members. Guests, please make sure your BlackBerries and cell phones, I'm sorry, this always makes me laugh a little bit. Don likes to make me laugh while I'm doing this. Please make sure your electronic devices are silenced for the meeting. We have no legislative action on our agenda today, and consistent with our COVID protocols, no public participants will be present today, only our presenters. Members, we have a surprise guest added to our agenda today. Until this morning, we did not think that he would be free to join us. During the past year, while Speaker Sprowls and the Select Committee were working on Chinese Communist Party interference in our institutions, our U.S. senators and other members of Congress have also been fully engaged in related oversight activities. Senator Rubio, a former Speaker of this House, has been kind enough to address us today. Welcome back to the Florida House, Senator, and you are recognized to address the committee.
Well, I apologize. I can't hear what you're saying. So if you can hear me, if someone can just wave, make sure you can hear me. All right, good. Well, I appreciate you guys holding this hearing on this threat. And I'm sorry I couldn't hear the intro, but I think this is about China. So a topic that I am more than happy to talk to you about for a few minutes. First of all, I'm glad you're having this hearing because really the real challenge we face is at the state and local level. The Chinese threat is unlike any counterintelligence threat the country's ever faced. They have three goals in mind. Let me just start out by saying China believes that it is their rightful place in the world to be the world's preeminent power. They view the United States as a declining power. They view recent events at the Capitol, the handling of the pandemic, and before that, the 07, 08 economic downturn as evidence of the fact that the future belongs to them and that we're on the way down. In essence, they view us as the United Kingdom was viewed in leading up to and through the Civil War and in the aftermath thereof. They also believe the United States is trying to contain them. And as a result of it, their goal is to, they've accelerated the timeline in which they're trying to move forward. And they're doing it a number of ways, obviously a rapid military expansion to be able to assert sovereignty over the Asia Pacific region, expanding their blue water Navy capability, which is the ability to project power throughout the world and have both control of ports in different countries and also the shipping lanes. They've also begun to exert their influence at international organizations. They do that one of two ways, straight up bribery. Second is they show up. And by bribery, that includes going into a country and building a project for them that makes no economic sense. But for the leader of that country, it's a big win and maybe some cash under the table. And that gets them votes at the United Nations and other international forums. The second thing is that they want to lead the world in key technologies. And they have two reasons for that. The first, the technological high ground is the high ground for power. But the other is because they have a big demographic problem. And that is they have a big demographic problem in which their working age population, because of their one child policy, is in very steep decline. So and they don't have any sort of social security system. So their two worries are their Chinese people don't consume. They don't buy a lot. They save a lot because they have to provide for themselves and they have to provide for their parents. And so they need technology to be able to be productive with less people, even though it's still a lot of people but in their mind. How does that tie into to you? Well, there's a couple ways of trying to do this. The first is they try to steal research. And they do that through universities, both by embedding graduate students in programs that leave with that research and send it back or take it back to China. And they have also, frankly, bought it. I mean, they have bought researchers. They've gone into universities and paid people or had side deals with researchers who sell them these advances. The second thing is the narrative, and that is that they try to influence American students to a pro-China narrative of the world, whether it's Tibet, whether it's situation with the Uyghur Muslims in the Xinjiang region, whether it's Hong Kong, whether it's Taiwan. They have a narrative and they pursue it. And their mind is, and it's kind of a hard thing for us to grasp, but their mind is if you're 19 or 20 years old now at a university, in 20 years, you'll be in the Senate, you'll be in Congress, you'll be in the state legislature, you'll be a CEO of a company. And so they try to, they really plant those seeds and are very patient about it long term. And so that's another way they influence it. And related to that, of course, is also local governments. They play a big role in local governments and in trying to reach out to local officials that they think could one day become governors, senators, congressmen, foreign, federal policymakers, and they try to create those relationships early on. On the student front, one of the primary ways they've done that is for example, through these Confucius Institutes, which are disguised or presented as Chinese Mandarin-speaking programs that invite students to China, but that's what they want to do. They want to attract America's future to China and turn them into a pro-China narrative in that regard. And local governments, they're interested in future leaders, but they're also interested in local projects. Their companies will come in and bid on local infrastructure or state infrastructure, and they can undercut any competitor, put your competitors out of business, and then you become the dominant companies in the world. And they've identified through the Made in China 2020-2025 plan the 10 industries they want to lead the world in. Particularly, they're interested in 5G because artificial intelligence and automated self-driving cars, the Internet of Things, additive manufacturing, the ability to 3D print things, all of that will be dependent on 5G. So not only do they want to be the dominant 5G power in the world, they want to set the 5G standards. Probably the easiest equivalent of that is, you know, those wall chargers that when you travel overseas, you have to buy the adapters. They want to be the standard, and they want us to be the adapters. They want our companies to be playing up to their standards. But if they set the standard, it gives them a huge advantage in terms of leading the world, not just in 5G, but in all the things that depend on 5G. They care a lot about our broadband, and in particular in rural areas where non-Chinese competition just isn't cost effective in terms of closing the digital divide right now in rural areas. And that has two advantages for them, again, market share. But ironically, they also seem to put a lot of these 5G towers near military installations, which give them a perfect place to put cameras and look at different military installations. And added to all that is, obviously, if they're embedded in our infrastructure, both here and globally, it gives them a huge intelligence advantage, their ability to capture information. So we could spend hours talking about the different ways from the state perspective. I would say the two areas that they're most interested in, or the three areas that I would really focus on, is their untraditional lobbying, because oftentimes the lobbying will come from a company, oftentimes an American company that has significant holdings in China, or a factory in China, and part of the deal is they have to come back and be ambassadors for China, oftentimes directly through people that work for their companies. Second is their investment and interest in infrastructure and infrastructure programs in the United States to undermine our domestic capability in those fields. And then the third is at our universities. And that's an enormous challenge where you have a lack of disclosure in many cases. We've had a couple instances in Florida where there are researchers, both graduate students and American professors, who have side deals with the Chinese and are selling some of the research, in many cases funded by the taxpayer, oftentimes, more often than not, funded by the taxpayers. So it's an enormous challenge. It'll define the 21st century, and there's only so much we can do at the federal level about it. We can provide disclosure and things of that. We can require disclosure, but it really is a sort of a state and local responsibility on some of these things, whether it's what's happening at our universities or what's happening at our local governments. And then just the awareness as well of the fact that, you know, if a wealthy, you don't get rich in China unless the government lets you. And the government lets you get rich. You have to, there's a price to pay. As the chairman of Alibaba recently found out, when he tried to spread his wings a little bit, you know, there's no Bill Gates in China. The only Bill Gates in China is a Bill Gates that does what the government tells them they need to do. So when he tried to spread his wings, he sort of disappeared for a couple of weeks and came back a lot more cooperative. So I'm glad you guys are doing this hearing. And again, I apologize. I can't entirely hear the questions. I hope I can, but I hope that that's been insightful.
Senator Ruby, are you able to hear us? If you're not, I would like to thank this time to thank Senator Ruby. Thanks, Senator Rubio, for participating today.
And I was asking, I tried to not use the earbuds. I did. I can't. Either way, it doesn't come through for some reason.
We appreciate the context that he's given to this committee for why the work that we're doing in this arena is important, and we appreciate the attention that he's drawn to these issues on a national level. With that, we want to thank him for being with us today, and hopefully next time, if we have the opportunity to hear from him again, we'll have the sound issues worked out. So thank you very much. Members, at this time, we'd like to move to just an update on a couple of different areas. At our first meeting, I gave you a brief overview of last year's Select Committee investigation into foreign interference in our research institutions. Today, we focus on those issues and related issues. I wish to start with a brief update, and then we'll hear from a number of other presenters. So last week, we communicated with Fred Pfluger, one of the FBI liaisons who assisted us last year. While the FBI was not able to join us today, he reported that Special Agent in Charge, Michael McPherson, is willing to update this committee in the future. Mr. McPherson appeared before the Select Committee last year. I encourage you to review that testimony on your own. Mr. Pfluger reported that both private and public universities have been showing initiative in flagging and investigating possible foreign interference. They have been extremely cooperative with ongoing federal investigations. He informed us that several universities, including the University of Miami and FIU, have established a foreign influence task force. He also referenced the recent DOJ indictment in the Northern District of Florida, showing the continuing federal commitment. The official DOJ press release on that indictment is in your meeting materials today. Mr. Pfluger gives this House credit for the progress in Florida and for helping drive the national policy shift. As to that policy, the outgoing federal administration produced a significant amount of work product during the past few months. In your packet today is a press release and a national security memorandum dated January 14th, 2021, covering government-supported research and development. Following that document in your packet, you will find a contemporaneously issued National Science and Technology Council report on recommended practices for strengthening the security and integrity of America's science and technology research enterprise. This document is a practical guide for both policymakers and institutions, and I encourage you to review it. Regardless of how the incoming administration may alter national policy, the best practices guide should provide valuable to our public and private Florida institutions. Speaker Sprouls is committed to pressing these issues to protect Florida's science investments and institutional resources from subversion and misdirection by foreign actors, regardless of federal policy. You can expect to see significant policy proposals this year, and I hope you review all materials provided to fully prepare for our consideration of same. With regard to the state university systems and institutions, last year we surveyed our state university system institutions on a number of research integrity and compliance issues. Recently, I requested each of our SUS institutions to update this committee regarding their progress since last March. Your meeting materials contain my letter and a chart tracking their responses. The full university responses are available in the committee office. If you want to review a particular university's response, please let the staff director know and he will get it to you. Some of the information our university has provided is confidential, and you should expect to review that information in our committee offices only. The University of Florida has been a leader in our state's pursuit of a more secure research environment. Last year, shortly after the Moffitt investigation surfaced, University of Florida reached out to then-Select Committee Chair Sprouls to inform him of significant investigations within their research community. One of the persons investigated by University of Florida, former Professor Lin Yang, was indicted in December by the Department of Justice for wire fraud and making false statements to a federal agency. That indictment was publicized by the DOJ on February 3rd. The Yang indictment announcement is in your materials, and you can read more about Mr. Yang's activities in the indictment press release than the Select Committee could release during last year's proceedings. The University of Florida has four presenters today listed in your agenda. They have made significant progress on research integrity issues since last year. Particularly encouraging is their foreign travel screening and tracking system designed to assist and guide UF research personnel who travel abroad as part of their UF employment. They provided three documents in your packet. Those are the three tabs following the Yang indictment. At this time, if they are ready, which I believe they are, I want to introduce Dr. David Norton, Vice President for Research with University of Florida. Dr. Norton, if you would introduce each presenter to follow you and have each presenter introduce the next, that would help to move our meeting along. I would appreciate that. Thank you, and you are recognized.
Chair, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. And I would be remiss if I didn't reach out and thank Senator Rubio for his support of University of Florida on this issue and other things. So we appreciate his activities and his support as we work together to do things for the university. I have with me three other individuals, Gary Wimsett, who is the Assistant Vice President for Conflicts of Interest at the University of Florida, Tara Du Bois, who is the Chief Compliance Officer for the University of Florida, and Amy Haas, who is the General Counsel. And we will speak briefly in that order, and then we're happy to take any questions that you or any of the committee might have. Madam Chair, the $900 million research enterprise of the University of Florida is remarkably important to the economic well-being of the state of Florida. The research that we do impacts the lives of people within our community, in our state and nation. The integrity of our research and how we meet the expectations of our sponsors and stakeholders undergirds all that we do. We take these responsibilities very seriously. The challenges that we, the U.S. research university community, have faced in recent years in the area of undue foreign influence from certain countries, while isolated to a few individuals, has been significant. At UF, we have addressed this issue head on, putting in new systems, policies, and procedures, engaging all relevant sectors within our institution, and partnering closely with federal officials in addressing isolated but significant instances of misconduct. The UF efforts have not gone unnoticed by our peers and federal partners. We have been asked by federal agencies on multiple occasions to share our practices and experiences with other universities who are addressing similar issues. We have been engaged with numerous national organizations in mapping out strategies to ensure that the issues are addressed while ensuring that the important research that our institutions do moves forward. Addressing undue foreign influence is just one part of U.S. research integrity program, designed to ensure accountability in a multiplicity of areas, ranging from how we conduct medical research, to how we perform defense research, to how we spend funding from state and federal sponsors. And with the chair's permission, I would now like to ask my colleagues, starting with Gary Wimsett, to address specific items that are pertinent to our present discussion. We'll begin with Gary, who is the Assistant Vice President for Conflicts of Interest, who will quickly describe Eufolio, our UF-wide system, capturing and reviewing all outside activities and conflicts of interest. Gary?
Thank you, Dr. Norton. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Gary Wimsett, and I'm the Assistant Vice President for Conflicts of Interest at UF. I've been working in conflicts of interest since 2009, and I serve nationally on the steering committee for the Forum on Conflict of Interest for the Association of American Medical Colleges. My purview at UF includes the identification and disposition of conflicts across the institution. I want to spend a few minutes, as Dr. Norton noted, talking about Eufolio, our UF online interest organizer. It's our disclosure tool. I want to talk a little bit about its impact so far and where we're headed. So in terms of the system, Eufolio is an important component of UF's commitment to safeguarding the integrity of our research enterprise. It's not the only one, and the Chief Compliance Officer, Tara DuBois, will speak after me about some of the other parts and pieces. So far, we have used the tool, the eFolio tool, to collect over 10,000 disclosures from over 6,700 faculty members. New disclosures are entered every single day, as a matter of fact, and today, actually, we onboarded several hundred non-faculty employees who will now start using eFolio, and they're drawn from our three highest job categories. So that will capture vice presidents, assistant vice presidents, directors, and folks in those types of positions. The impact really so far has been fairly staggering. Faculty have really embraced eFolio for its ease of use, and that leads to greater compliance. Chairs now understand their obligations to conduct preliminary commitment reviews. College deans have instant access to the disclosure data. University officials responsible for ensuring compliance with state and federal laws and university policies now have broad access to data and the reporting tools that go along with our system. Importantly, every activity or interest disclosed becomes part of a permanent searchable record. Disclosures are carefully vetted in a multi-layer review by chairs, the COI program, subject matter experts in intellectual property, state and federal law, and our international risk group when applicable. The entire review process is marked by dialogue between disclosers, chairs, deans, subject matter experts, as evidenced by the several thousand clarification exchanges captured in the system. This turns the disclosure process itself into a powerful education and training tool. As far as the future, we continuously add educational content to eFolio, our COI program website, and other university information portals. We are now working on warehousing our eFolio data for even broader use by other university offices. We are committed to software enhancements and continuous quality improvement, and eFolio today is better than it was last year, and it will be better next year than it is today. So I thank you for your time, and I will pass it to Tara DuBois, the Chief Compliance Officer.
Thank you, Gary. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address the committee today. As Gary said, I'm UF's Chief Compliance Officer, and my office serves to oversee UF's compliance efforts and support the culture of integrity at UF. We recognize at the University of Florida that enhancing the security and integrity of our research enterprise requires a multifaceted approach. There's no one action or one person that alone will achieve the goal. As you see in our presentation today, with all of us being here, we work collaboratively across our university from the research office to the provost office to general counsel and compliance, which demonstrates organizational leadership and oversight in this important area. Central to our approach is a firm expectation of openness and transparency established through our policies and disclosure requirements. As Gary mentioned, we've already collected over 10,000 disclosures in eFolio. For any of those disclosures that either involve an agreement with a foreign entity or will take place either in whole or in part in a foreign location, our international risk assessment team automatically receives the disclosure through eFolio and then performs a thorough review. Notably though, our international risk assessment team doesn't only review eFolio disclosures. Our process is developed to pull in other types of international activities in which UF might engage. For example, our subject matter experts review all sponsored research agreements that are between UF and a foreign entity that might involve international travel or that involve collaboration with foreign research partners. Also, any gift agreement wherein a gift is provided to UF by a foreign entity is routed to our experts for review. So by looking across the university to identify places where international activities might occur, and then centralizing the review of those activities, we've cast a wide net that allows for comprehensive review by subject matter experts so that we can identify and then mitigate any risks to the integrity of our research. We like to think of our international risk assessment process that I just very, very briefly described for you as the hub of our approach to prevent against undue foreign influence. From there, we have other processes that serve as spokes to identify and assess other risks relevant to international activities. One key spoke is our longstanding export control program. That program has measures in place to identify sensitive and controlled information and research projects. It limits access to U.S. persons where that might be required by law, and it ensures researchers utilize secure computing resources while doing that type of sensitive work. Other measures we have in place include requiring prior travel for all international travel, or excuse me, prior approval for all international travel that's on UF business. We track UF equipment that is leaving the country, and we require registration within our international travel registry, which flags planned travel to comprehensively sanctioned countries and sends regular reports to our export control office. So by bringing all of these core disclosure and review requirements together with the other activities we take, like continued education and outreach to our researchers, and of course, in the event of non-compliance with university policy, we apply thorough investigation and consistent disciplinary actions. We're employing what we like to think of as a holistic approach that will allow our researchers to be successful while continuing to safeguard the integrity of our research enterprise. I'm going to turn it over to Amy for some closing remarks, and like we said before, we'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, and thank you for having us today to provide a brief update on where we've come since last year. I'm happy to be the point person for the committee to answer any questions that you may have about any of these processes, systems, or sort of just ways of handling and trying to manage the situation that we have put into place. Just a couple of follow-up points to the rest of my colleagues' conversation here. One of the sort of ancillary components, and I know we received an email about this from Mr. Rubottom, was just to note in terms of our compliance structure overall with international activities and assessment and screening, our export control office, which sits in the Office of Research, has some robust and sort of long-standing information that we would be happy to share. They monitor for export controls and OFAC compliance predominantly in the travel space. The other thing I was just going to mention, as you heard about our constant dialogue and discussions and the diligence we try to perform as we're evaluating activities, especially those in the international space and requests for those activities, is this group that you see right here from UF. We meet just about every Friday, some combination of this group, to really talk through and assess these requests and figure out what is the best way to approach these requests so that we get the information that we need and make sure we have all of that information. And then finally, I just wanted to mention Gary Wimsett's system is incredibly useful for us in spitting out real-time data and metrics. And really, that's been quite an enhancement for the University of Florida from our old paper system of a couple years ago. Happy to share with the committee examples of that type of data that we're able to collect in terms of numbers and requests and even the breakdown of those activities. And then finally, if there are any questions about the recent indictment of our former faculty member, Lin Yang, I'm also happy to address those. For those of you who were committee members last year and Madam Chair Grawl, this individual was faculty member number two in the packet where we were not allowed to disclose at the time because of the ongoing investigation, but that material is now public material. And I'll stop there, and I'm happy to answer any questions or help to direct questions to the appropriate UF colleague.
Members, are questions? Yes, Ranking Member Davis.
Thank you, Chair. The question I have is I heard a repeated in reference to the International Risk Assessment Team. Could you tell us who are the components or the people that make up that team for us, please?
Madam Chair.
Recognized.
Thank you. I will turn it over to Tara Du Bois. She's been actively involved in that process, just to elaborate on that question and answer that for you.
Absolutely.
So our international risk assessment team consists of individuals within our research integrity office. So research integrity is a division within our Office of Research that reports and is managed directly by Dr. David Norton. So within that unit, we have an associate director and several compliance specialists. And those folks have been involved in certainly the foreign influence in issues since the beginning of the university's involvement. Before that, those individuals came from areas that supported our global research activities. So these are folks who kind of are very familiar with international research concepts in general here at the University of Florida. We also have our export control officer who sits within that division and helps on those reviews as well. So those are the core members. They are the individuals that will receive the routing of any activity, whether it's an outside activity or a UF agreement that might be with a federal entity. They will be the first to receive those activities, and they'll take the first look review. From there, they can escalate on up to a group that consists of many of us that are sitting here, and then other folks who may be relevant, depending on the case, whether that's a dean of a college or an associate dean or a chair, depending on who they need to involve.
I do have a question, and I'm not sure who it's best directed to, but I'll let you all decide that. With regard to Mr. Yang's indictment, could you please kind of give the committee the benefit of what the activities that led to the charges and the indictment against him, and then also follow up with the current state of your eFolio system? Would that have prevented those activities from happening? Would you have identified him earlier, how much earlier, and what steps would have been able to be taken if you if had the current system in place? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll take a stab at both parts of that question and then turn it over to Gary Wimsett for any follow-up on eFolio. Lin Yang was, for the benefit of the members of the committee, he was an associate professor in the College of Engineering and the Department of Biomedical Engineering, hired to the University of Florida from Kentucky in 2014. He was one of the two individuals identified in an NIH letter that we received in January of 2019 that identified Yang as possibly being involved in a foreign talents program in China and possibly having other support undisclosed to the NIH in connection with the receipt of his grant. As we began to investigate Dr. Yang, we worked very closely with both our regional FBI, our local liaison for the FBI, as well as the national team that was working closely with the NIH. And through that investigation, we were able to determine that there was enough information to indicate that Dr. Yang was invited to join a talents program in China. We were unable to determine at the University of Florida through a review of evidence and documents whether he had actually accepted that appointment. He proceeded to do much of his work on systems outside of the university that were discovered through FBI subpoenas and the U.S. Attorney's Office. But we did learn at the University of Florida that Yang was actively owning and had started a company in China that he had concealed from the University of Florida. We did have a paper process at the time, meaning that if you wanted to engage in an outside activity, you would answer questions on a piece of paper, and you would submit that piece of paper to your department chair and to your dean in the college and seek approval to do those activities. Yang did not disclose this Chinese company to his college. In fact, he failed to disclose it each year he was here, and when asked for specifics in January of 2019, he once again said, "I have no activities in or related to China." So he actively concealed, at least from our information, his involvement with this company or any activities or programs in China. At that point, we informed him he would be under a formal investigation. This was back in 2019, and he resigned shortly after receiving that notice. We then proceeded to work closely with our FBI, continuously cooperating with various subpoenas, et cetera, so that they could have all the information we were able to gather at the University of Florida. But obviously, they have access to things that we don't, including outside accounts like Gmail accounts that he was using to do some of these outside activities. So as to the question of, would our system catch this type of activity now? I think we would have had the potential to do so, and here's why. Obviously, bad actors are bad actors, and if they lie to us and actively conceal, that's a more difficult thing for a university to try to uncover. We don't have access to some of those things that the outside world has access to in terms of really doing, that type of investigation or that type of look into whether someone is telling us the truth or not. But two things we do now that I think are improvements upon where we were. One is we've taken this determination of conflicts of interest out of the hands of the colleges. This college, the College of Engineering, is incredibly responsible, and we're very fortunate for that here. But the process itself could create a conflict, I think, when you leave it within the colleges and the academic units to determine whether their faculty members are engaging in some activity that is contrary to their duties to the university. Number one, they just don't understand. These are deans and department chairs whose jobs are not to understand the rules of conflicts of interest and the statutes and the regulations in that field. So I think centralizing the office with subject matter experts like Gary and his team would enable us potentially to have caught and stopped this type of activity that Yang engaged in. I think secondly, what it would have done was caused us to probe a bit more. Now, if we, bad actors can still exist. And this system is also designed to require every faculty member to go into the system at least once a year, even if they have nothing to disclose. So our hope is that process that we've put into place, if it doesn't enable us to catch the bad actor on the front end because we don't have the right tools or enough tools as a university to enable us to do that, that we at least have information on the back end that makes it quite easy to hold someone accountable very swiftly. So, I think the honest answer is I don't know. I don't know if it would have caught this particular individual, but I think it certainly gives me comfort to know how we've moved the process into a central office and that we perform diligence and we require disclosure even when there is nothing to disclose. We require certification of that.
Thank you very much for your answer. Members, are there any other questions for the team from University of Florida? Yes. Representative Byrd, you're recognized.
Thank you. Are there any governments or regimes with whom your faculty members are prohibited from entering into research agreements with?
I'll start, and then I'll kick this over to Tara, Madam Chair, if I may be recognized.
You are recognized.
Thank you. So yes, we follow, and as I mentioned, we have an export control office that manages and monitors international activities, international travel, international bringing of things, or international or disclosure of things to a foreign national, and that evaluates. I don't even remember how many lists there are now, but there are multiple lists over over a few dozen of foreign entities, foreign individuals, foreign institutions that the United States government has declared are not available for the U.S. to offer anything of value to. That could be a device, that could be intellectual property, that could simply be information and education. And so we do have by matter of sort of U.S. law and regulation in place a system to monitor for activities with prohibited or restricted entities or individuals. We have not, to my knowledge, sort of extended that as a university beyond those lists that the United States government has and that they update frequently. And I will let Tara speak if there's anything sort of more specific that would be helpful, you think, Tara, for the committee here.
I think the only thing that I could add is that, as I mentioned in my remarks, while, like Amy said, we at this point right now do not have, you know, sort of prohibitions by country. We have prohibition by entity or individual that may be on one of the U.S. government denied entity lists, and in that case, we would not allow our faculty to participate in those engagements. But beyond that, like I said, I think, you know, we really take sort of a holistic approach, and so I think, you know, that's why we get as detailed as we get in our review. That's why we've centralized it the way that we have, and we have a, quite frankly, small team of subject matter experts. You know, for the size of our university, we really consolidate that knowledge, and the reason is because those folks, you know, they're used to seeing certain things. They've been doing this now for quite a while, and so they ask the right questions, and they dig, and they paint the entire picture. So I think, you know, I think we look at it like that. There's often, you know, these things, almost in all cases, they're not, you know, cut and dry, sort of black and white, and there's a lot of gray, and we recognize that, and we appreciate it, and that's why we put the staff on it that we do.
Representative Byrd, you recognize her follow-up.
Yeah. And thank you for the response, and that's what I was looking for. I mean, we started with Senator Rubio, who said that China is the preeminent threat to American national security and talked about the genocide that's taking place with the Muslim Uyghurs. So I'm just trying to understand. So the University of Florida is not taking any independent position. You're just relying completely on who the federal government says, either individuals or entities that your faculty can't engage with, but you're not taking a holistic approach to the threat of the Communist Chinese Party, which is everyone in China.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The one piece I would sort of add to the approach of following the United States rules and regs and lists of the prohibited entities is the part of that international risk assessment that we do. We're not taking a holistic approach as the University of Florida in terms of, you know, sort of saying broadly, you know, no work in China, and that would be a challenging thing, I think, for us to do sort of at the local jurisdiction level as a state institution. But we do, as part of our international risk assessment, look not only at those entities or institutions that are prohibited, we also look pretty closely and do a lot of diligence at those entities where there are restrictions, they're not prohibited, but you can do, you know, ABC activity, you can't do XYZ activity. And we do take that into account often when we decide, is it worth it? We're doing a cost-benefit analysis to say, you know, is the activity, does it support the mission of the University of Florida? Does it further the mission of the University of Florida? Because it's a bit risky when you're doing it with entity X, where you can play over in this sandbox and not in this one. And oftentimes we find that the benefit is not there. And I think that is something that we've done a better job of in the more recent history than perhaps, you know, we did in the past. I think it's something we focused a bit more on as we've sort of gained this understanding of just exactly what the strategy is with some of these governments and what the activities really might look like as compared to what they are sort of advertised to be, if that makes sense.
Members, are there any other questions? Well, I'd like to thank the panel from University of Florida for presenting today and for your continued work with our committee as we address this topic, and for your cooperation in the last year and a half, for sure. So thank you very much for being here today. Members, one initiative of the Federal Department of Education in the past few years has been to improve reporting of foreign donations by our nation's universities and colleges. Reporting foreign donations of $250,000 or more is required by the Higher Education Act of 1965. In October 2020, the U.S. DOE Office of General Counsel issued a report on institutional compliance regarding the requirements of that law. In this report, they describe major American universities' efforts to avoid reporting of significant gifts and donations. They also express grave concern with institutions' failure to report donations to university foundations and other intermediary organizations solely to benefit a single institution. That report is in your meeting materials. In our survey this past week, we asked our state universities to report foreign gifts and contracts greater than $50,000 since January 1st, 2020. The five smallest reported nothing significant. Others have significant gifts from Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and many other nations. Notably, UF, UCF, and FIU all have contracts with companies in China. UNF has a global health certification program with Shandong University in China. In January, the U.S. DOE sent a letter of inquiry to President John Thrasher regarding FSU's non-reporting of foreign donations. That letter and the university's lengthy response are in your meeting packet. Robin Blank, FSU's Chief Compliance Officer, is here today to address us. I've asked her to update the committee on the progress and to go over the foreign donations inquiry with us. Ms. Blank, you are recognized.
Thank you, Member Davis, members of the community and the committee. Ms. Rubottom, thank you for the privilege of speaking with you today. On behalf of FSU, we appreciate your interest in preserving the integrity of our research operations. I'm pleased to chat with you specifically about the issue of foreign gifts and donations, and also give you a little bit of a background about where we are and where we might be generally on research integrity issues and on conflict of interest. In contrast to the very real significant security concerns and the space that China is existing in and attempting to exist in, that Senator Rubio provided to you and is frankly making me question whether I should continue a career in compliance, it does give me an opportunity to show you the other side of what global collaboration can be. We didn't invent global collaboration, and frankly, neither did these guys. But the need for collaboration beyond our national borders has been at the heart of some of the greatest developments of the last 100, 125 years. I desperately hope that you're able to see this photo or have some familiarity with it. It is the group shot from the fifth Solvay Conference on Physics, at which the most notable physicists of the day met in Brussels to discuss the newly formulated theory of quantum physics, which is at the basis of modern computing today. Albert Einstein is in the middle. He's kind of hard to miss. Two seats to his right is Marie Curie, the first woman to win a Nobel Prize, and the only person to win two Nobel Prizes in two different areas of science. To her right is Max Planck, the originator of quantum theory. Second row on the far right is Niels Bohr, to whom we owe our understanding of what atoms look like, with the protons and the neutrons in the middle and the electrons spinning around them. With Max Born to his immediate right of wave theory fame. A few seats down, I would be remiss if I did not mention Paul Dirac, for whom FSU Science Library is named. In the back row, you have, among others, Erwin Schrödinger, yes, the one about the cat that is dead and not dead at the same time, and Werner Heisenberg, who may have used his talents to sabotage Hitler's efforts to develop the atomic bomb. It is likely that Solvay conferences would have continued into the 30s and 40s, if not for World War II. Many of the conference participants, either because they lived in countries under strife or because they were Jewish, ended up fleeing. Some, like Albert Einstein, never returned. To say nothing of the disruption of the war itself, There was also the distance. Remember, this is the 30s and 40s, and we have significant problems with collaboration on a global scale. It's hard to imagine, and many scientists lament, where we would be in the field of physics, computing, science travel, atomic energy, and so on, if not for the war. There were no conferences on physics between 1933 and 1948. So why am I showing you these dead white people? Well, this is because international partnership and collaboration can do really, really good things. Yes, the regulations and controls are absolutely important. The dangers posed by China, Russia, and others, malign actors everywhere, are real. Regulation and our ability to comply with those regulations is of essential importance. But there is a lot of good that can come out of international collaboration, and striking that balance is what we as universities aim to do. It's not an accident that over the past 50 years, FSU has gained significant prominence on the global stage. We've done so by building partnerships in academia, service, and research at both the faculty and student levels. We also rely on our ability to collaborate internationally to assist us with meeting a variety of preeminence metrics goals, especially those related to patents, success in the STEM fields, research expenditure, and postdoctoral enrollment. As ambitious as our international goals remain, we balance them against those obligations to secure our people and our property. We also value our relationships with our faculty and staff who hail from countries that are currently on the regulatory radar. I hope to provide you some insight today into how we're managing these, and I invite you to visit this page, global.fsu.edu, for more information. I think you're pretty familiar with the regulatory landscape. I put you first, and that's not by accident, but you are in good company with the new-ish statute that was passed in 2020 around foreign interference on research integrity. Clearly, there's a lot of interest in how to prevent malign actors from interfering with our research, stealing our stuff, and taking advantage of our global footprint. Just to give you an idea of what this alphabet soup is, and I apologize if this is a review, but obviously we have the FBI and the DOJ who are working on the criminal side of things. Many of these opportunities involve federal grants, making false statements to federal regulators. Obviously those are within federal jurisdiction. U.S. Department of Education, the Section 117 reporting that Chairwoman Graw was telling you about, that is the function for universities to report gifts and contracts with foreign entities that exceed $250,000 each calendar year. We also have the Office of Management and Budget, Section 889 provisions. This is a little more obscure, but there are prohibitions on entities that are federal contractors, which is a lot of the research that we do, so we do serve as a federal contractor on those grants, possessing or using certain pieces of telecommunications equipment that have pieces or that are manufactured by certain companies, many of them from China. So we have to make sure that we disclose that. And there were new regulations in that area in the end of 2020. Also, you have your PHS policy requirements. Those are the significant financial interest and significant conflict of interest disclosures that are required by federal granting agencies. And then we have, to top it all off, we have also our internal requirements for our faculty and staff to tell us if you're engaging in outside activity or if you have outside financial interests. Gifts and donations. You have in your materials our February 5th, 2021 response to the preliminary inquiry from the Department of Education on this issue of on the issue of international contracts and gifts. I'm happy to answer specific questions that you have about that. That was a preliminary inquiry. There was no accusation of any wrongdoing. The inquiry was essentially, you're really big, you do a lot of stuff, you talk about your international footprint a lot, which we do. We're not sure that it's possible that you don't have all of these contracts or all of these donations coming from all around the world. So we said, okay, we'll look. And we looked. And we didn't find anything that we had underreported or not reported. We did invite DOE to tell us if they wanted us to report things differently. Their guidance that was issued in October of 2020 was informative on the way that they wanted universities in general to report things. But we did give them a decent explanation of how we are reading their current statute to include institution, their definition of institution, how universities are structured in a way that the institution That definition is something that is very specific, and that there are affiliate groups or corporations with the institution that fall outside of that definition. And also, we had this weird situation where we had a lease agreement, which we continue to have, with an entity in London, because we have a study abroad program there. And that particular agreement, that contract, was expressed in British pounds. So we had to, the Deputy General Counsel, Lisa Scholes, who wrote that response for us, looked at what the exchange rates would have been for those years on the possibility that we would need to provide information on that if it exceeded $250,000, which it did not. So I'm happy to answer questions about that. How is FSU managing foreign gifts generally? Most of our foreign gifts come in through one of our foundations, which are direct support organizations that are designed to support the university. We have two major foundations that work in this area. The first is the FSU Foundation. That's what we call the Big Foundation. And the FSU Foundation utilizes FSU's license for this group called Visual Compliance that basically has the ability to look at a large variety of the types of federal lists that Amy Haas was telling you about. So you have embargoed countries, embargoed personnel, restricted party screenings. Visual Compliance does all of that for us. There's not a lot of foreign gifts coming into the research, into the foundation itself. In the second half of 2020, the foundation reported 41 individual foreign gifts. Only two of them exceeded $50,000. The FSU Research Foundation has access to that same Visual Compliance license and uses it, and has an additional robust set of processes to vet both gift and grant funding. On the sponsorship side, so money coming in, the Research Foundation vets all sponsors from foreign countries and has the full use of the Office of Research Compliance for any questions about sponsors. On the payment side, should the Research Foundation need to pay a foreign person or a company on a grant, they must be screened against the U.S. Department of Treasury's specially designated nationals list, and we also have the Glacier system, which ensures proper tax classification for any international payee. You also have in your response FSU's accounting for gifts and contracts exceeding the $50,000 threshold that you provided in our response just last Friday. One of those contracts is a lease for that space in London again. That's through one of our DSOs. It is not an institutional agreement. The remainder comes from the FSU Research Foundation, also a DSO, which manages all of our foreign sponsored grants. Occasionally, there will be a question of, is this really a gift or is this a grant? Is it a gift? If so, it probably comes with very few strings attached. If it's not a gift, or if it's a gift that's if it's a grant that is masquerading as a gift, in other words, someone says, I want to give you a gift, but here's exactly what I want you to do with it. That's a grant, and that's going to be going through the FSU Research Foundation and also through our sponsored research program. Related to our issues around foreign interference and outside activity disclosure, we provided in response to your survey question a copy of FSU's form specifically on the issue of foreign government recruitment talent programs. We have been using that to onboard every new hire, faculty, or staff since May of 2020. Our current outside activity disclosure process is currently paper, more on that in a moment. But we have a very robust approval process that moves from the person to their supervisor, department head, dean, and then for our faculty, it goes to our faculty development and advancement team. Otherwise, if it's a staff member, it goes through HR. If there are questions about whether the outside activity can be approved because there's a potential conflict of interest or because the proposed activity might violate the code of ethics, it comes to my office for additional review. We have acquired and we are in the early discovery phases of moving our current paper system to an online system. The software that will house that is the same software that underlies UF's eFolio system. So some of the same pieces that you just heard about will be something that you will see with FSU. We expect to go live with that in probably late July or early August of this year. The discovery process also necessarily includes a discussion about whether our policies are currently where we need them to be in order to support the best and highest use of this system, so that we are also in a policy review type of situation right now. One of the things that you've probably heard from other universities, because we all have this in common, is we operate under a system of shared governance. Our faculty is unionized, and some of our disclosure requirements are governed by a collective bargaining agreement. Current outside activity disclosure for faculty is its own separate item within the CBA. Our negotiation team has prioritized this topic for the upcoming bargaining season. The implementation of the new system will necessarily require us to train our faculty and staff on how to use it, and also to any changes we make to policy. My pitch to those who are resistant to change or who prefer a weaker disclosure system generally, either because they don't want to have to check one more box, they don't want to have to tell us about what they're doing, they think that it's some sort of an invasion of things that they're doing that have nothing to do with the university, is, look, we're not trying to prevent you from doing consulting work or outside work that doesn't interfere with your job. We're actually trying to make the process easier. And you should like that. And full and proper disclosures protect all of us. Protects you, it protects the company that you want to work for, and it protects the university. I haven't gotten a lot of feedback on whether or not that pitch is going to work, but that's what I'm going with. No doubt there is a lot of work to do here. The team I have for this project, I would put up against anyone. I have outstanding support from the Board of Trustees, the President, Vice President. Everyone has been outstanding. We all realize this is a priority, and it must be resourced properly, and we must have time to do it. This is another alphabet soup. Sorry about that. Maybe a fist bump graphic would have been better here. But one of the ways, I have a very small office at FSU. One of the ways that I make sure that we're doing the right thing is by engaging and talking with other folks, including the FBI, our DOJ locally. We have a group of compliance officers at the university level in Florida from which I derive a lot of benefit. We also are members of a group called the Council on Government Relations, an association of research institutions and medical centers that provides insight, advocacy, policy suggestions on issues affecting the research community. We also benefit from a membership in the Association of University Export Control Officers, which is exactly what it sounds like. Our export control function, as you heard UF talk about, is really embedded and a necessary component of these issues related to foreign influence. So we've been able to utilize our export control office and some improvements that we've made, including the introduction of a software module specifically on export control to enhance the way that we look at travel, what people are taking with them when they go places, what types of things are coming into the university. And much like UF, that has been in existence for a long time. That's a very, very strong part of our research operation. I'm here, I'm live, I'm not a cat, and I'm happy to take any questions that you might have.
Representative Duggan, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understood you to say that the reporting and vetting of outside interests begins in the departments and colleges and then flows up through a chain of reporting. Ms. Haas with UF said that that is entirely centralized because they're not convinced that those academics are fully attuned to all the nuances of the reporting requirements. Is that an intentional policy difference? Are you going to re-examine the decision in light of what Ms. Haas said? Can you give me some background on why it is the way it is and where you intend to go from here?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Representative Duggan, Ms. Haas is right, as she usually is. She's been a colleague of mine for a long time, and I've derived a lot of benefit from that for two reasons. One is there does tend to be, because it's not something that they deal with every day, department chairs and deans do have a lack of appreciation for how complex the conflict of interest rules are. The second is that if we leave it to an individual to decide whether the conflict exists, and that person is the one who is either interested in doing the work, or that person is the supervisor of that person and may derive some benefit of that work being done within their department, they're always going to say there's not a conflict. And so we, with the implementation of this new software, one of the benefits is that it makes the disclosures better. People are required to go through a systematic workflow of answering questions, kind of like a choose your own adventure book, where the questions lead them to better questions and better questions and better questions until we're satisfied that we know everything about what they're proposing to do. And also it centralizes that function, and that will be in my office.
Follow up?
Yeah, Madam Chair, this is really a question to you. Are we gonna have debate after the presentations?
We are not going to have debate today, but we will be considering policy that is derived from all of the conversations we're having in committee today.
Then I would like to add to that discussion list this issue of the disclosure of the conflicts of interest being subject to collective bargaining. I think we need to take a hard look at that.
Representative Valdez, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you so much for your presentation today. My question to you is, out of the undisclosed monies that you've received for research, what type of research has the university undergone?
I'm sorry, may I ask for a little bit of clarification? What type of research are we doing, or what types of research have we undergone to discover what those issues are?
What are those monies being used to research?
I don't know if I could tell you exactly what they are being used for in each individual college. I can tell you that one of the areas that is frequently funded by the international community are in the STEM fields. That's where the international interest is. That's where the money comes from. And specifically some of these countries that are of concern, like the countries in the Far East, much of that development is in the STEM fields for the reasons that Senator Rubio has identified. I'd be happy to get back with you if you'd like a little bit more information about specifically where those projects are and where those are coming from.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Follow-up?
You're recognized for follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So understanding, I guess maybe my question is, what steps is the university taking in order to streamline the approval of these donations coming in? And I apologize that I'm not framing my questions correctly, but this document was just given to us shortly before, so I haven't read all this documentation to have an intelligent conversation, so I apologize that my question is kind of vague.
You're recognized to answer.
Thank you. I think that I could probably, the question is not the problem. I think I could probably answer it two ways. One is, on the foreign donation side, we do not have a lot of unrestricted gifts coming from foreign places. And the system that we currently are working with to vet those, using visual compliance, looking at embargoed countries, looking at where the sanctions are, and deciding whether or not to accept a true unrestricted gift, because we have those only coming in through the foundation or only coming in through the research foundation, that's pretty tight. I think we do a pretty good job of keeping those pretty closed off and making sure that we have full assessments. If there are issues, whether it's, is this really a gift or is it really something else, or does it create a conflict, those come to my office. On the grants and contracts side, if it's sponsored research, that goes through a module that's already set up on significant financial disclosures and conflicts of interest, and that's consistent and compliant with the PHS guidelines. So it's the same as anything that's coming in from NIH, anything that's coming in from Department of Health, anything like that. It's that same process. That's been very streamlined, and we onboarded that process within about the last year.
Representative Byrd, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just note that the picture you showed with the Solvay conference, I think that everyone that you mentioned in there was a citizen of a Western liberal democracy. I don't think any of those at the time were citizens of a communist Chinese government that, by Senator Rubio's words, were the preeminent threat to the United States. But my question is this: can you go back to the comment you made about collective bargaining and expound upon that? Because I'm like Representative Duggan, I want more information on what is being collectively bargained with regard to this topic.
You're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. Our faculty union has a specific article in its collective bargaining agreement, I believe it is Article 18 or 19, on conflict of interest disclosure. Currently, that article does not require faculty members to report what our general counsel refers to as the null set. In other words, if you don't have anything to disclose, or you don't think you have anything to disclose based on your understanding of what a conflict of interest is, then you don't fill out a form. We see that as problematic. Representative, I think you might too. And so that is an area where we are putting our powers together in both the creation of a new online system with also, hopefully, the opportunity to tell faculty, you need to be reporting even if you have nothing to report. It's just clicking a no box. We're making it very, very simple. Because I don't think I'm giving away the farm here. The problem is that if you don't have to report the null set, we don't know if you didn't report or if you don't have anything to report, if you intentionally didn't report because you wanted to hide something, or because we lost your form. That is problematic. And we are trying to close all four of those gaps within the next 6 months.
Follow up, Representative Ford.
Do you know if any of your other sister universities in the state have that collective bargaining requirement, or is that just FSU?
Thank you. I think many of our sister institutions might have been there a year ago or 2 years ago, and that they have made efforts to do the same thing that we are trying to do.
Representative Stevenson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would share some of those concerns because I'm not an attorney, but I don't understand the difference of not having a conflict and saying I don't have a conflict affirmatively. I don't know if that has an evidentiary impact, but if it's required by law, it doesn't seem like it should be subject under the union negotiating contract. I'm troubled by that comment as well. Hopefully it will resolve in a orderly manner. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Sullivan. If I could frame that as a question to you, are you under the impression that if there is a statutory obligation to disclose that conflict, that that would trump the union contract?
Clearly, any provision of the CBA is subject to existing law, and the CBA cannot usurp existing law by agreement. Where I think this issue becomes problematic is in the interpretation of the definition of conflict of interest. So outside if you're in the research sphere, those are very, very well defined, and people who are doing sponsored research have been familiar for a long time with having to disclose what truly is a conflict of interest as those terms are defined by the PHS regulations. In the outside activity realm, which is of equal import, although it might not involve so much interaction with foreign governments, it could be a conflict of commitment. It could be I am trying to be engaged with an entity that doesn't currently have a contract with the university, but might be responding to a solicitation in the future, and maybe the university knows about that, but maybe the employee does not. And so while I hear you, it should be very, very simple. The way that conflict of interest is defined in Section 112 does leave some room for interpretation. That's why we have the Commission on Ethics opining on these issues quite frequently. But the narrowing of that, if that occurred or if that came out of this committee, certainly the CBA would not be at its whim to disregard that or try to contract around it.
Thank you. Representative Smith for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your comments today. It's certainly thought-provoking. As it relates to, I guess, what you've heard from Rep. Byrd and Duggan, also in linking back to Senator Rubio's comments about the pervasiveness throughout the United States as China's reach, my question is there any mechanism? Do you participate in any best practices exchange? Is there a compliance officer or association that I mean, for not only through the university system, but state colleges, private universities, through higher education that might be involved in, outreach or some type of foreign espionage or however you want to characterize it? Are you involved with that type of best practices exchange in the state of Florida? Thank you.
You're recognized.
Thank you. I am. I greatly benefit from those relationships. The smallest one is probably the State University System Consortium, which is just the group of compliance officers within the state. There is a national group called SCCE, which is a consortium of compliance professionals. They also issue certifications for compliance professionals. Several of my colleagues are members that does a lot of that best practices work. I think you also heard a reference earlier today to the most recent J-Corps report and the presidential memorandum on best practices and opportunities for improvement. I didn't include it because our response to your most recent inquiry was getting a little bit big, and I'm not a huge fan of spreadsheets, but we have created a spreadsheet that lists all of those best practices, tries to prioritize them. This is the work of Diana Key, our export control officer, to try and figure out which of these is priority, which of these best practices are we already doing, where are we close, where are we really far away, and that that is also being done by groups like COGER and groups like the University Export Control Office Group. So yes, there are lots of those groups. There's also NACUA, of which I am a member, which is the National University and the National Association of University and College Attorneys, that does a lot of work in this area as well.
Representative Thompson, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your presentation. I have a question regarding academic freedom. When there is a gift, when there is research, is there any obligation or any pressure to present a certain viewpoint or to substantiate a particular hypothesis? And I guess the crux of it is, how much reliance can you put on the research if there are strings attached to a grant or a gift?
You're recognized.
Yeah, that is a fantastic question. I mean, a gift that involves that many strings is not a gift. It might be a grant, but if it presupposes a conclusion, or if it necessitates us to operate in a certain way, not only would that grant not pass our muster, it wouldn't pass our sponsored research groups. And from an academic freedom standpoint, you know, the academic freedom as a legal issue belongs to the institution. It doesn't actually belong to any one individual faculty member or any one department. And so we have to make determinations, much as you heard from UF, about, does this support the university's mission? And if the university's mission has to do with free expression and the exchange of ideas and not favoring one viewpoint over another, which we can't do because we're public institutions, then that's a gift or that's a grant that we wouldn't be able to accept because it doesn't hold with our values.
Representative Roach, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to just touch off that question. Do you have examples or do you have data on how many times, if any, such a grant has been refused when it refused to meet those categoricals?
I do not, but I can get that for you. I appreciate the question.
Thank you.
I'd be happy to follow up with you on that.
And I have just one last question for you in terms of the foundations, FSU's foundations. Do the foundations and I know you described two, I think, bigger ones. Do they report gifts, donations, and grants to the DOE, the U.S. DOE, if they meet that $250,000 threshold?
They do not currently because they fall outside of the definition of institution for which 117 reporting requirements are based. In our response to the inquiry from DOE, we went ahead and reported anything that might be reportable to them anyway. So we told them about the possibility that we had the leases that might exceed the $250,000 threshold, depending on whether you were counting dollars as pounds or the other way around. And then we also let them know about one or two research foundation grants that had come in during that time period that did exceed $250,000. But we explained to them, here's how our DSOs work. Here's why DSOs are outside of the definition of institution. But if you want us to report these differently, we are happy to do that. And we are doing it now in an abundance of caution in an effort to be transparent. But our reading currently of that federal statute does not include direct support organizations.
Is there any federal or state agency which you are required to report the gifts, donations, or grants that you receive in your foundations or your DSOs?
Yes, if they are grants, then certainly they are subject to disclosure through the sponsored research programs. And the idea that it only exists in this nebulous chamber of the foundation is not any sort of an excuse not to report. Or a way to hide things that are not to be reported. If it's truly a gift, we report gifts publicly, even from anonymous donors, every single year. Is there a reporting requirement at the federal level for unrestricted gifts from foreign entities? I don't know that there currently is, or if there is one, it's at a very high dollar threshold.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your presentation today. I know the committee appreciates it, and we look forward to further conversations as we move along in this policy area this year. Members, we have one more speaker today. Senator Rubio recommended our next presenter. Peter Mattis works with the Congressional Executive Commission on China. He has broad and deep knowledge of China's aggressive interference with American science and technology, both in academia and industry. A previous presentation of his is in your meeting packet. We appreciate him taking the time today to update us via WebEx on our concerns from the federal perspective. Mr. Mattis, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, the members of the committee. As someone who was working on these issues before I joined the staff of Senator Rubio and the Congressional Executive Commission on China, I was involved in a number of conversations. I testified before Congress. I worked with reporters and some foreign governments in trying to address this problem and how to think about it. And what is taking place in the Florida legislature is a really remarkable local level initiative that I frankly wish would be duplicated elsewhere in the United States and also elsewhere in the world. Because as you well know, a federal government, whether it's in the United States or Canada or Germany or Australia, has some responsibilities, and the states have their own rights and responsibilities. And this is a problem that all of us can deal with together, and we're best dealing with together in complementary efforts to make sure that there aren't regulatory gaps and that the laws are consistent and consistently applied. As my boss, Senator Rubio, noted, China's leaders seek to displace the United States and for China to play a central and defining role in the way that the world works. But to achieve this objective, the Chinese Communist Party still relies on the United States technology, the knowledge, as well as the financial capital here to be able to continue its rise in the world. And, you know, that's sort of a positive, you know, a proactive vision of what they need to do. But a sort of more protective or negative component is that they also have to prevent American values, democratic values, from going back into China. And this is these two drivers, you know, both fear and a lust for power, are why we have the problems that we do. And it's important to remember as we sort of reconfigure our policy on China at the national level and shift away from the kind of blanket encouragement of years past into a more competitive stance, we have to remember that we can't compete if we continue to keep supporting the party and allow its system to use U.S. knowledge, U.S. technology, U.S. capital as a crutch for the problems in their own system. This drive for power, and, you know, both to project it out into the world and to protect it at home for the Chinese Communist Party, is the reason why they've built a rather large bureaucracy that is in nearly every party committee, from the one that governs the country into the provinces down to local levels, sometimes even in corporations and in organizations like the China Academy of Sciences. This United Front policy system is, broadly speaking, about mobilizing anyone outside the party to serve the party's interests. And so for China's leaders, the important distinctions are not about China and the rest of the world, a border around the People's Republic, but rather the Chinese Communist Party and everyone else. And as a result, it reaches out in a number of different ways, and I think it's worth highlighting three particular ones for you today. The first is the effort to control Chinese community organizations abroad, such as the now defunct Florida China Council, or Florida Council for the Peaceful Reunification of China. These community organizations are about the protective role, keeping an eye on the Chinese diaspora abroad to ensure that these are not people who are able to take sort of American ideas and transmit them back into China in ways that that would be dangerous for the power of the Chinese Communist Party. The second, and you know, where it's particularly relevant to Florida State and the University of Florida today, is that they're talent spotting for the right expertise. There are organizations, there are at least 10 or 12 different organizations in the United States that exist solely to facilitate the transfer of technology and expertise back to China. They're there to identify who might be useful, regardless of who they are. The third is an effort to control the interactions between the American people and the Chinese people. You know, as Senator Rubio noted, you know, today's legislator, today's mayor is tomorrow's governor or tomorrow's senator. And we have a case out in California that's worth noting about now Congressman Eric Swalwell. He himself probably did nothing wrong, but by happenstance, he was targeted and he was cultivated. And he probably didn't even recognize that it was going on until the FBI came to approach him to describe what this was. All of these efforts are designed to ensure that the party controls the way in which the Chinese people interact with the world. And they bring control through convenience. On our side, that control is applied when these community organizations or Chinese Chambers of Commerce or sister city arrangements are used to bring delegations of local politicians, of local business people over to the PRC to have conversations, to create agreements, and to build connections. You know, we accept them because they're easy. They make it simpler. But the problem by accepting the Chinese Communist Party's frame is that we're now allowing our scope, our aperture into what's taking place in China and how we engage in it, be controlled in a particular way. If we don't look at what we're doing in these arrangements, whether it's a business one, whether it's a research partnership, we run several risks, and I'll just highlight a couple here. If we don't look at our research partners in China, we may end up helping the Chinese military improve its ability to sink American ships, kill American service members, and otherwise harass or harm our allies and partners. If we don't look at some of the Chinese community organizations as local politicians, you may end up letting the CCP represent American voters to you rather than finding another way to engage constituents. This is another form of that convenience, right? We have to interact with organizations because they bring people together. But if those organizations can't maintain their own integrity, then the party ends up speaking for those individuals. If we don't restrict the CCP's ability to operate relatively freely inside the United States, then we deny our ethnically Chinese citizens and our Chinese guests the full rights and dignity of being Americans and being guests of the United States. You know, this is something in which we all have some sort of role to think through what we're doing and how we look at it. You know, this is, as Americans, we have agency and we have choice, and we have the ability to choose to engage or to not, and to make judgments about this. I'll finish with three observations that I think are worth noting, particularly in the case of tech transfer, but they also apply to anyone who's having to engage China. The first is that list-based approaches don't work. So anyone who relies entirely upon the entity list promulgated by the Department of Commerce or the specially designated nationals list that identifies individuals that are, I believe, are not allowed to use the U.S. financial system. This doesn't work because we're facing a moving target. The Chinese government and others will adapt to a list and come up with a new name or a new organization, a new front company, and continue working around it. It's important to keep a list, but it's a starting point. In the particular case of China, and where it becomes critical to engage, is that they have a strategy called military-civil fusion, which deliberately blurs the line between civilian and military technology and is premised on the idea that advances in the civilian sector need to be harnessed much more rapidly for military usage. And so a lot of ostensibly civilian companies in China are actively engaged in taking their product or taking their research and engineering it for military usage. Now, these may be civilian companies, but they're not necessarily going to appear on the entity list because there are a wide range of issues that they could be working on, and the resources at the federal level or at the state level are not necessarily there to do all of the research and identifying everything. The second is that we're designing rules to be principles and not specific to any country. And that's important and it's necessary, right? However, it's something to remember that all of the enforcement, all of the digging into this, you know, some of it can be done simply with functional expertise and knowing how to ask the right questions. But if you're trying to identify a Chinese company that's involved in military civil fusion research and is actively supporting the PLA and diverting its technology for military usage, you're going to need country-specific expertise. You're going to need a Chinese language researcher who can use Chinese language, and they're going to have some knowledge of the country's policies and rules and laws and what the obligations of any given company are going to be under that. You know, one of the nice things about all of China's laws that have been passed in the last 6 years is that they've set very clear expectations of what Chinese people are going to be expected to do. And it behooves us to be familiar with the national security law, the national intelligence law, the national cybersecurity law, and a number of others that explain what needs to take place and what the expectations are of Chinese citizens. And the final point is that it's important to us, for us as Americans, to live up to our values, right? Our values of community, our values of the rule of law. I've done a lot of research on economic espionage on the part of China, and one of the unfortunate realities is that a lot of what has been taken by PRC nationals has come from people who never came to feel like the United States was their home. They may have spent years here. They may have even naturalized as citizens, but they never put down roots and never felt integrated into their world. And if we don't give people dignity, if we don't integrate them into our lives, if we don't find opportunities to reach out to our neighbors, then it's not just a matter of civility or civil society. It's also a way in which we lose some of the talent and the opportunities and the diversity that makes the United States a great country. Thank you very much for giving me this time.
Thank you, Mr. Mattis. I appreciate your presentation today. I know the committee does as well. Are there questions? Representative Duggan, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mattis, during his comments, Senator Rubio referenced the use of 5G for espionage purposes, including the siting of towers near military bases. Do you think it's his policy or his suggestion or maybe just your thoughts on state-level legislation that would address the placement of those towers around military installations? Do you have any insight on that you want to share?
You're recognized.
I think that's a very necessary risk to evaluate because 5G telecommunications have a degree of fidelity in terms of locational data on individuals that it behooves us to be careful where towers go simply as a matter of security risk.
Representative Byrd, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Mattis. I'm going to read part of Florida Statute 876.01. To my knowledge, no one has ever been convicted or charged under this statute, but it deals with criminal communism and says that it's antithetical to constitutional government and that the advocacy of such doctrines, either by word of mouth or writing, or the promotion of such doctrines independently or in collaboration with or under the guidance of officials of a foreign state or an international revolutionary party or group is unlawful. Based upon your expertise and that I just read you the Florida statute, do you believe what the Communist Chinese Party is doing in Florida would violate Florida law?
You're recognized.
I think some of that activity might do so, but it's in terms of the way ideology works for the Chinese Communist Party, it's sort of like an operational code. It's not a belief, necessarily a belief system for saying, you know, that the state should own the means of production, or the way we might have previously thought about ideological indoctrination. Most of what is meant at this point by ideology in for the Chinese Communist Party is, in a sense, providing the operational code, the culture, if you will, of the party, the tools, the objective that they should be working for, the tools that they should be using. And so I think that makes it difficult to apply the statute as I understand what you just read.
Recognize for follow-up.
No, thank you. Thank you for that answer. And let me ask you this. Do you think that the universities in Florida, and I'm not impugning any bad action, but do you believe that based upon what we've heard today and your knowledge of what the Communist Chinese Party is doing, that it's wrong to place a moral equivalency between other Western liberal democracies like New Zealand or Australia or the United Kingdom and China? And this isn't just regular economic competition between nations, but this is literally a national security threat that we are facing from China.
You're recognized.
Well, I don't think any reasonable person could equate Germany and China, that, you know, there are real distinctions in the way, you know, even our most socialist European country partners are, in terms of the way in which their government interacts with the private economy, are hugely different than the way that China, the Chinese government, the Chinese Communist Party interacts with their economy. And you know, these are not the same, and it's one of the reasons why, you know, I wanted to highlight that enforcement has to be somewhat country specific, because resources and time are finite and prioritization has to take place. And I think you could say that there is a difference between a Germany and a China. But I think it's important to recognize that you can't just leave it like that. You know, in one particular case, a German university, University of Heidelberg, was essentially colonized, if you will, by Chinese researchers. And this became a hub for the way in which the PRC learned about artificial intelligence and quantum computing. And many of China's intellectual leaders in these fields went through the program that had been built up and are now back in the PRC, leading programs of their own at different research institutions there. So, you know, I think that this just reinforced the idea that you can't just put a list and have a checklist and walk through it. I'm sorry, I forgot the first part of your question.
Oh, I'm good. You answered my questions. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, members. Are there any other questions for Mr. Mattis? Seeing none, Mr. Mattis, thank you very much for being with us today and giving us that context and for the work that you've done in this area. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me, Madam Chair.
Members, I appreciate your involvement in this conversation today. And as we consider this policy, I encourage you to look through the materials that were provided in preparation of the meeting and the work, look over the work that was done by the committee last year. If you have input into how we guard, we can guard in Florida against malicious foreign interference in our state university systems and our government, I look forward to hearing from you. The staff would like to hear from you as well as we consider this important policy moving forward this session. With that, Representative Tant moves that we adjourn without objection.